This is Gargoyle Library. I'm your host, Dan Morin. Welcome to the first episode of this brand new podcast on The Incomparable, in which we're going to talk about the Disney show Gargoyles, which debuted in 1994. I have assembled an excellent panel of people who are interested in talking about this very fine animated television series. With me are Kathy Campbell. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Glenn Fleischman is here. Hi, Glenn.
Well, you have an excellent panel, and also me. Thank you for having me.
you're quite welcome. Shannon Southerth is here as well. Hi, Shannon.
Hola, frikis.
lest that not be enough, we have two Southerths. Chip Southerth is also here. Hi, Chip.
Don't you see, Dan? None of this would have happened if it weren't for you.
Yeah, that's probably true. That's I apologize broadly. And rounding out our panel, my good friend, Mr. Tony Sindelar. Hi, Tony.
Hi. What sorcery is this, nerds?
It's actual sorcery. That was in my notes.
I know. Yeah.
So I'm asking you, which type of sorcery? Yeah. Give me a page number.
Yeah. Page 43, Tony.
Necromancy, yeah. Who knows?
Citation needed.
Please.
It's just magic.
The chapter titles and...
All right. So we are kicking off this new series by talking about the 5-episode arc that begins this show, which is entitled Awakening. But first, before we delve into that, we're going to talk a little bit more broadly about the series. I will say that I saw this when it first aired in 1994. I'm pretty sure I watched it at the house of a friend of mine and Tony's, and that he and I watched it together. And I remember seeing commercials for it because I watched a lot of the other Disney afternoon stuff that this was packaged with. And this was also one of my earliest memories of a show that I engaged in the internet to try and figure out, like, when new episodes were coming on. I was actually on a mailing list. I think it was like the first mailing list I was ever on, which actually like sent out messages when it's like, oh, there are new episodes, because it was so hard to figure out in that day and age when things were repeats and when things were new episodes. This show had a big impact on me, not only as a writer and a storyteller, but also just like it got me interested in things. I read more Shakespeare because of this show. Like I specifically read the play Macbeth because of this show for reasons that become apparent later on. So
Dan, is this show what leads to you being an English major?
That's quite possibly. You could probably draw a pretty clear line. So this was a big impact on me. I think it's a wonderful show. It's very unlike a lot of the other stuff that was airing at the time, and that's why, you know, we are not quite at the 25th anniversary. I think that's actually next year, but we're pretty close. So, you know, we'll consider this sort of grandfathered in along those lines. So let's go through and see what you guys, your experience with the show as a whole, how you came to find it, etc. Kathy, how did you first encounter Gargoyles?
Very similar to you, in fact. I was a big Disney Afternoon fan, and this show in particular is one that... So I was 12 when it came out, and it was one of the few shows that my brother and I would ask to watch together. Like, we would enjoy watching it together, and then we also would proceed to, I guess you could kind of think fan fiction-y, as in, like, we would take blankets and wrap them around our shoulders to pretend to be our wings to go flying around the backyard. Yes, at 12, because I am... So it had an impact on like my relationship with my brother, because we would fight over what other shows we would watch, but if Gargoyles was on, we both would 100% agree on that. And I don't think we actually saw... So rewatching these first 5 episodes, I think I may have seen one or two of these 5. But so the very, very beginning was kind of new to me, and it was very exciting to kind of get that refresher course and actually get the full story, because growing up, I never really knew that shows came on a schedule. Mm-hmm. And it was always just reruns in my brain. And so learning when I was probably in my 20s that shows came out new was really exciting.
Yeah, I mean, and even more, I think, than in other shows of this era that were also notable. I'm thinking of, you know, Tony's done a lot of talking about Batman the Animated Series. Gargoyles had a much more linear progression. Like, the story is sequential, right? Things that happen in early episodes affect things that happen in later episodes, which was not the case with most animated series at this time. So, yeah, I can understand that being that being weird too, right? Like as a kid, weird. Like, wait a second, the story is not over. It continues next week.
I have to wait again.
Yeah, it's rough. That's rough.
Yeah.
Glenn, you're, I'm going to put this delicately, you're a little older than us. I'm curious to know because...
Let me get my cartoonishly large ear horn.
I'm curious to know because I know that, you know, Kathy, myself, Tony, I think we were probably all like in the teenage years when we watched this. I'm curious how you came across this.
Explain yourself, Glenn.
Glenn, what's wrong with you and why are you a child?
Shouldn't you have been studying or like... Holding
you're
down a
responsible
day job?
Adult or something at that job. Point.
I watched this during its original run because back in the 90s, as everyone recalls, it was hard to watch things again because unless they showed up on television again or you could program your VHS player, I think I may have recorded this on VHS to watch in the evening is my suspicion after I worked my job, a thing I no longer have as well. things I had in the
90s. Not related, probably. Didn't put you out of a job.
No, I remember watching, I mean, this comes off my love of Batman the Animated Series, even though it's very different, and the animation style, I mean, I have to say up front, it is pretty coarse compared to Batman the Animated Series, and even some other things at the time. They really did skimp, like, I enjoy plot, a fair amount of dialogue, sophistication, all that, but anyway, so I'm sure it was because I'd watched Batman the Animated Series, which I think was off the air a new episodes by the time this came on. Is that right? It sounds right.
Pretty close
to it.
I overlapped a little bit, but there's no way we would know that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm looking at the internet right now, but I remember, I'm pretty sure I watched the original run. I know it was rerun at times, but I don't know how much. So a lot of these episodes are familiar and I have a recollection of like, isn't that funny though? You forget what technology you used 20 years ago. It's like I would come home because I certainly wasn't home at like 3 p.m. I guess I would come home from a job that was away from my house and use my VHS player, which had been correctly programmed, to watch it later. That's my suspicion, at least. But I found it, I had the same reaction to it, like I say, in many ways to Batman the Animated Series, in that the thing I loved about Batman was how quiet it was, how often they're willing to take a pause and have very spare animation and have, you know, no dialogue, but advance things with like really neat elements. And while it wasn't a perfect show, it was really great. And in this show, I thought, gosh, even in these first, I mean, there's some coarse stuff in this first 5-parter, but there is always throughout the best episodes of the show, a sense of, not just moral ambiguity, but of like, what exactly is the right thing here? Is there somebody in the right here? Is everybody in the wrong? I mean, Goliath is seen as this moral center, and yet he often makes decisions without enough information. So he makes what are wrong choices enough to rectify it. So I thought it was complex enough, even though the plots and things are sometimes very simplified or simplistic. Having lived in New Haven in the late 1980s and into the early 90s, and my wife having lived in New York, it reminds me watching this show again. I'm like, oh yeah, New York was really dangerous. When they were writing this show, they were thinking about a time in which like you could like, oh no, we can't go to Central Park at all because we might be beset by armed people. If your car breaks down in any neighborhood, thugs will come.
Not just thugs,
up.
A multi-ethnic
That's right.
Yeah. Especially street gang usually reserved for musicals.
This is like a Michael Jackson gang will come and get you. I think it really did represent, I'm watching it, and it's a show that I think is very much in love with New York City or a certain version of it. There are things in the show I even noticed that were like very specific New York elements. Anyway,
It's so very much Disney's pre-gentrification New York.
True.
Yeah. And it was realistic in that sense because there's a lot of violence. Like, yeah, you know, you can have an armed band of people shooting machine guns in Central Park and the police, they're not going to show up. Why would they bother? This is happening all the time.
Yeah, I think you hit upon one interesting point there too, which is that this is a very un-Disney show, and that is what probably drew a lot of us to it, like compared to certainly a lot of the other stuff that was airing in the Disney afternoon. And I loved things like Tailspin and Darkwing Duck, but like those were very traditional cartoons. This was very much against the grain, and that I think is what drew a lot of people in.
It also had something to do, I think, with Beauty and the Beast, the TV show that was a few years before it with Ron Perlman. I think there are definitely aspects of Gargoyles that borrows from that.
And they even touch upon that more directly later on, too. And there's at least one episode, I think, that kind of alleges that. Yeah, this show was actually originally developed as a comedy show, sort of in the same vein of Disney's Adventures of the Gummy Bears. The gargoyles were going to be comedic figures. There were going to be wacky hijinks, and
Hunchback gargoyles.
Yeah, very much so. And I think that as they were trying to break the story, as they were trying to sell the story, they kept getting into roadblocks, and they saw the success of Batman the Animated Series. Especially in Awakenings, there are moments where the animation feels much more Disney than action-adventure. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the character who will become known as Broadway sniffing the algae in the rookery, and he just looks like a Disney character. Mm-hmm. And that sort of fades as the series goes on over the years. But I feel like this was a complicated mix of action adventure and Disney afternoon. And I don't know that Disney knew exactly what to do with it, even mm-hmm. though the showrunner Greg Wiseman, I think, clearly did. And it turned into a cult favorite.
Yes, with good reason, I think. Shannon, how about you? How did you first encounter the show?
Chip and I sort of fell into it together, and Chip, feel free to jump in. But I remember vividly one thing that sort of got us interested is hearing about it as it was about to come on. Some of the voice actors that they had, Jonathan Frakes and Marina Sirtis and Michael Dorn, all of these Star Trek Next Generation actors, they're all doing this project. Hey, okay, that sounds interesting. And let's see what's up. And of course, once we started watching, an interesting storyline, the kind of continuity as we kept watching, the kind of continuity and attention to that, that we fell in love with watching Babylon 5, which is a show that relies incredibly heavily on the continuity. You can't just watch an episode here or there and jump in. And Gargoyles, in especially later seasons, turned into that. If you hadn't been watching previous seasons, you wouldn't know what the hell was going on.
You really relied on that previously on.
And that works for me. I love complicated stories. I love stories that get into details, get into character arcs. All of these different characters have journeys. And, once it had my attention, it kept it.
Chip, anything you want to add there?
I just remember, and when we get into this specific miniseries, I vividly remember missing the first few minutes of the first episode. So when I sat down in mm-hmm. front of the television, it's the year 994. And I didn't know that this was going to catapult into the future until the end of the episode, and they go to and they show the opening credits late because they didn't want to give away the store, and I'm like, wait, that's a helicopter?
Right.
I'm actually really glad that I missed that, because that moment of surprise was magnificent.
I didn't know they had helicopters in 994 AD.
Revisionist history.
must be some kind of dragon.
Tony, how about you?
Dan, we are of similar age, and so thus our stories are similar. This was part of that block of stuff that you could watch in the afternoon when you were a kid. I think in junior high when this was coming on, and I was the kind of kid who would go
you
home.
You people
after
are too
school,
young.
Go home after school.
We're the right age. We're the right age.
Right. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Age.
Look, I didn't interrupt your story, old guy. watch a sizable block of television while doing my homework and until dinner time. And I think, that block adjusted over the years. But Batman and the Animated Series was definitely a cornerstone. Gargoyles was another big cornerstone. Next Generation reruns were a big part of that. So those were, I think, other Disney afternoon stuff, probably most notably Darkwing Duck were big parts of that. Mm-hmm. But this was one of the really big ones. And I think some of it was just, it is this kind of in-between, is this a kid's cartoon or is it something darker, more serious, with more complex storytelling? Just rewatching these first five episodes, it is it's interesting where it's like, sometimes this feels like a kid's cartoon and I can see the, like, the Disney afternoon influences, and sometimes it's a lot spookier and a lot more complicated. They still pull their punches a lot with the kind of depictions of violence, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of fights in these first five episodes, but there's never violence, and there's a lot of, like, laser guns and just kind of explosions blasting people, sure. You know, here and there. But yeah, I think this grabbed me right away as something that was kind of not necessarily geared directly for younger kids, when there wasn't a lot of that on the air back then. You know, there would be a lot more as, you know, Cartoon Network would come and build up a giant empire, and you'd have more animated shows on Comedy Central and things like this. But this was this early in-between thing. One of the things I would note about it, and this may, you know, I guess it maybe comparisons to the Gummy Bear shows are in there. I feel like there's a lot of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles DNA in Gargoyles. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's set in New York. There's the one human female character who's going to help the weird monsters fit in and navigate things. They live in New York, but they're outsiders. There are only four types of teenagers, and as you know, they are mopey, nerd, hungry, and Boy Scout, I guess. Which, you know, Voltron uses the same formula because, that's how that works. But yeah, I don't know. I've always very much enjoyed this show, and definitely it was a tricky show to have as something that just aired every weekday when you have these longer plot arcs, right? I mean, the premiere for this, you would have had to watch 5 days in a row at the same time every day, and if you missed it, you missed a pretty important chunk of the story.
Yeah. I mean, and that was definitely a tricky proposition.
I want to point out one tiny thing, too, which is that this show has a lot of mythology, but it doesn't explain much. And I kind of love that they're just like, what are gargoyles? Why do they become stone when the sun rises? How does this magic work? Are they oviparous? Are there very few females relative to male? Where are the, you know, the eggs? There's like a lot of questions that don't make any sense, but then they do things like this. And I highlighted this to my wife because I thought it was super clever. She's like, can't you fly us back up? He's like, no, I can only glide. I'm like, oh my God, what a great choice. And it affects the entire show. Mm-hmm. Instead of making it simple, they obviously already have a ridiculous wingspan to, you know, volume ratio and could not really glide probably very well. However, they didn't go to the thing like, well, they have enough power, they can just fly back up. I thought this is a brilliant constraint. So super large amount of what their backstory is not mentioned at all. We can't even infer it. And then they have great little technical details like that work their way into the show. And I kind of appreciate they didn't have let's go back to the origin of gargoyles, you know, in whatever, in caveman time thing. So,
well, I have a lot of questions about their mass when they're turned into stone. Never, it's magic. Don't worry, people. just relax.
I'm still curious about the eggs.
This leads into something that, you know, talking about this first five-part miniseries opening, which I think works really well, which is, as Glenn is saying, like, the rules are kind of given up front. We get a lot. It's very economical in terms of, like, what is happening. We don't always get the why. But the fact that they do turn to stone during the day, you know, is one of the things that's set up right at the front. And it makes for interesting constraints for these creatures, right? Because not only does it mean they are vulnerable during the day when no one is, like, they are not awake, so they can be just essentially smashed, but it provides an interesting dynamic with some of the characters, the human characters around them. Especially I'm thinking of the fact that later in this series, in this five-episode arc, Goliath doesn't want to tell Elisa, like, why that they're vulnerable, right? He is worried about being betrayed again. And so when she finds out and we see it through her eyes, it's genuinely startling, even though we know it's going to happen, because we sort of get the perspective from her of, like, what the hell just happened? Like, that's super weird. So I appreciate that, like, with the gliding thing, a lot of this stuff and the fact that the sleep heals them, right? Like, we see to Tony's point about the violence, one of the first shots involves Goliath catching a sword and actually bleeding, which is unusual in a cartoon.
Right.
But we also established that then it is healed later. So it's nice and economical in the way that it sort of lays out this world and the constraints of this world.
Also, their clothing turns to stone for some reason, which I'd love. It's never explained. It's awesome.
Magic, Glenn. Magic.
I like
standards and practices.
Something else.
Could be Arnold Schwarzenegger bit there.
Missing the first couple episodes in my original watch that I now discovered was the fact that they didn't come with names. Goliath was the only one named. And so when I was getting ready to watch these, I was like, why in the world do they have New York names? Because I remembered distinctly that they had these names. And I was like, that's so odd. And then to discover, oh, because they were named in the future, like that makes so much more sense. But having them just be their characters without actually being named for what, the first three episodes?
Yeah, like, it's a long time. It's like a bold choice.
It was very bold choice, because how can you say, like, yeah, you're being cast as unnamed gargoyle number two? I'll put that on my like plan, my schedule. And yeah, I thought that was a very interesting decision to make.
I also want to touch briefly on Shannon, I think, mentioned the voice casting. The voice casting in this series is tremendous. Not only because there are so many Star Trek veterans, not just from Next Generation. There's people from almost every show up at one point or another.
It's astounding. I was looking up at the Wikipedia to remind myself, and seeing some of the guest actors that show up later on.
It's crazy.
I mean, you get people, I'm trying to remember now.
Nichelle Nichols is in there. Avery Brooks is in there. Alan Cumming is in there. Yeah, like really great.
Who did the voice casting, though? I assume it would be Andrea Romano, but I don't think she's listed for it.
No, it's the voice director is Jamie Thompson. I'm not sure about casting. I don't remember that credit.
Somebody must have knew. I mean, it's fascinating. And that was one of the reasons I liked the show, too. I think at some extent is, you know, Next Generation was still on the air then. It was just off, right? It was just on the air. And I was like, oh, this is great. And I mean, Jonathan Frakes in particular, and Jonathan Frakes and Marina Sirtis had an incredibly good time. And the fact that they got Ed Asner, I mentioned this to my wife, and I was like, well, they probably had him in a studio for like 2 hours on one day to record the whole show.
He's in Batman the Animated Series, too.
Yeah.
He clearly was available.
So. I like to say, too, I love the fact that he is the only one to commit to the Scottish accent. He's going to be like, yep, I'm doing the Scottish accent. You guys can go screw yourselves.
I've had Canada. He's old. He's settled in his ways. The other ones are all trying to fit in New York and are really good at that. So, yeah.
Well, and I want to point out, obviously, this would be remiss if we didn't talk about Keith David. Goliath, who is fantastic, and as the anchor of this show, right? He really is. He's our main character.
Yeah,
everything relies upon that performance being sort of spot on, and I love how much he commits to this. And what so impresses me about it is, for example, if you watch these episodes in the first scene, I think, when Elisa shows up to the tower and everything's going to hell, she talks to a beat cop, right? And that beat cop is also clearly Keith David, but it's totally a different voice. But he's got such vocal range to go from the big, you know, like deep stentorian Goliath down to these, like, I think he's one of the thugs too, frankly. You can kind of hear it when you listen. But and then just the range of all the other, like, you know, professional voice actors who are in this too, right? Like all the most of the young gargoyles, you get a lot of Jeff Bennett in particular, who I think does not only Brooklyn but also Owen, right?
Yes.
Yeah, like,
and the Magus.
Yeah, I mean, like, think about all those characters. Those characters are totally different, right? Like, and yet one person voicing them. Frank Welker does Bronx.
Of course.
Yeah, so yeah. Great cast. Clancy Brown is the villain at the beginning.
At this moment, I did not realize that Sally Richardson, like, I'd never actually looked up who did the voice for Elisa Maza, and I thought she was Elisa. All right. She, I thought, I really liked that role. I thought the role was generally fairly well written, and I liked the voice characterization. And then I'm like, oh, who was that anyway? I'm like, oh my God, she's been in a million things. And was also my favorite character on the very flawed show Eureka that I watched most of, because I kind of liked some of the actors on it. They were amazing, but she was probably my favorite actor on that role. And I'm like, oh, I didn't realize it was the same person until just this moment.
Yeah, and I think for her in particular, that character could be a very simple two-dimensional character. And in this mini series, I think we only get a little bit of her.
Yeah.
They do such a nice job later on of really fleshing out her character, her family, her background, like all of that in a way that was also not done a lot.
And her action scene in Central Park is remarkable.
Yeah,
I mean, she's the star. She's the star of the show for that entire sequence, and very much.
Chip, where did her gun go? At one point, she takes off her jacket, and she has an empty holster, and I've forgotten where her gun went.
Goliath crushes it in the previous episode.
Oh my gosh, thank you. I did not remember that.
Continuity.
There we go. Good. But it was no, it was beautiful. I'm like, something happened to her gun. This is not a mistake, and I did not remember that's what had happened. That's great.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I'm here to help.
I liked the fact that we have, you know, this cop that comes in, and it was a female as well. I mean, that was something as a young girl. I was like, there's a main character, and it's a girl, and she's a bad...
And like, she's a POC. She's Hispanic.
Yeah. In fact, I think she's part Native American, right? And
she's biracial.
Everybody defers to her, too. They take her seriously.
Yeah.
Because in later episodes, we meet both her father and mother separately.
Right.
And I think the actress, Sally Richardson, is also... has like a mixed background too, which is it's nice, right? Like there's a mixed race character being played by a mixed race actor. That was not necessarily the norm at that point either.
She's African American, Native American mother, white father of Italian English descent, says Wikipedia. But no, that was I feel like that's unusual. I was surprised. I was like, oh my god, she actually looks something like the character. That was rare.
She's not blonde and blue eyed,
right?
And
exactly doing a voice.
Mm-hmm. And I think in fact, I'm guessing they probably modeled some of the character on the actress, just given how close those two things are. I would not be surprised if that was the case there.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Go
ahead. I was just going to say they modeled Keith David. I mean, they modeled Goliath off of Keith David too, obviously. Yeah. I mean, the wings and the horns and everything.
It's uncanny. It's uncanny. I do want to talk about some more of the characters, but I'm not sure if we should go through some, like briefly go through the plot, or should we just discuss more broadly? How do you guys feel? You guys have a particular preference? No?
We can do plot, then plot, then characters.
All right, let's do a broad overview.
Some plot.
So, as we already sort of talked about, what's interesting about this show is that we start off very brief. We have sort of this teaser in the present day, and then we jump back to Scotland. And the premise is set up that we have this castle. It is defended by the gargoyles. They are stoned during the day, but they come alive at night. So when these invaders like show up and attack, you know, everybody thinks the leader is crazy because he's attacking, you know, when these supposedly mythological creatures are going to come to life. He doesn't believe it. Of course, they turn out to be real. And so we end up with this whole fight scene where the gargoyles really, you know, sort of pull their weight and drive people off. But what then gets interesting about this is we find that, of course, the gargoyles are not accepted by the society, particularly the sort of high echelons of the society. We have a princess who really looks down on them. We have the Magus, who is her advisor, who is also not a big fan. And pretty much their only ally and defender is the captain of the guard. The unnamed, I always thought it was interesting, unnamed captain of the guard. Mm-hmm. And so we have this sort of betrayal plot, right, where the gargoyles are, we have this gargoyle speciesism where they are treated poorly, and we have somebody betraying the castle and the princess, and essentially like convincing the person who attacked to basically try their luck again at daylight. There's a whole thing with a ruse where Goliath is lured away, and we find out more later about the whole sort of like sequence of events there, which ends up being again fairly complex because of the betrayer, of course, turns out to be the captain, who is the only person they trust, but the fact that only Goliath and Hudson, I'm gonna use the names just to be convenient, are the only ones to leave the castle means that everybody else is left undefended. And that we then have, you know, the invaders come and essentially smash all of the gargoyles except for our three young heroes who are hiding out in the rookery with all the eggs and the dog. And
the dog is very confusing.
Right. Yeah. Why is the dog a gargoyle, but also a dog?
Gargoyle beast.
Do not question this magic.
Bitten by a rabid gargoyle.
Probably. You have to have a good boy.
Yes,
it raises some concerning questions of parentage, and you know,
I feel like it's a whole Pluto Goofy issue too. Like,
yes,
maybe he's not a dog. Maybe he's just
it's not. He's just he's very like soft spoken. So
yeah,
so Shannon made the talk.
Wings Shannon made the comparison to Babylon 5 earlier. Another point of comparison here is that the creator and showrunner of Gargoyles, Greg Weisman, was also fairly active online, and he would painstakingly explain to you online that Bronx is a gargoyle beast, not a gargoyle, and you know there's a taxonomy here.
So
I should have read the novelizations. I know.
So we have another sort of, as the invader Hakon captures the princess and the Magus, we end up with this slightly awkward sort of misunderstanding where the Magus believes that the princess has been killed by Hakon because the gargoyle showed up, and so he essentially casts a spell on the younger gargoyles in Hudson that freezes them into stone even during the night. Goliath goes after and saves the princess, but loses his chance at revenge on Hakon and is surprised to find the captain is the person who betrayed the castle. And so, of course, when he returns, you know, he doesn't know what has happened to his friends. The Magus explains he's put a sort of curse on them, that they sleep for 1,000 years or sleep until the castle is raised above the clouds. And that he can't undo the spell because the page has been burned in his tome. And so
Magus is not a very good, it's not a very good memory. It's like, yeah. He's, you know, seemed kind of like a poser.
If I learned anything from Zatanna, you should just say that spell backwards. and so Goliath requests that he also be put to sleep, their return to the castle. And that is when we jump forward. And 1,000 years to our quote unquote present day, or at least of 25 years ago. And we are introduced to the very interesting character of David Xanatos, who I want to say is personally, I think, one of my favorite characters on this entire show.
Yeah.
I love, first of all, Jonathan Frakes. We all is great.
Always.
Xanatos is basically like, he's like,
he's jerky
evil.
Tony Stark.
Yeah, he's evil Tony Stark, which I love.
I love it.
You know,
which is almost redundant.
More,
yeah.
Maybe slightly more evil Tony
but
Stark.
What makes Xanatos, I think, compelling is the fact that he's a villain, and yet he is not necessarily always villainous. Like, he's in that weird gray area. And that's what I kind of dig about him as a character, is that he is at various times ally, like, you know, a grudging ally versus actual antagonist. And in this case, we learn that he has like heard the legend of the gargoyles. He has moved the entire castle lock, stock,
brick
and barrel,
by brick.
Brick by brick, and rebuilt it on top of his skyscraper in New York, because that's a totally normal thing to do.
I did like the amount of effort they put into depicting how the thing was disassembled, though. That was pretty very impressive. Like, there's numbers on things, they're packing it up, they're flying it away. I'm like, this is a lot of effort to show. Well, they could have been like, we packed up the castle and moved it. It's an interesting choice.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice. I mean, the Magus' spell, until the castle rises above the clouds, that's a very, very specific metaphor there. It's very
it must rhyme in magic language or something, right? There's gotta be like
magic.
Or like every spell has to have like a clause. They've invented magic and the lawyers got to it, so it's like every every spell has to have an exit break so that it doesn't get caught in the loop.
If you've ever signed a contract that says in perpetuity till the end of the universe, you know that just doesn't work. So it's got to say, I sign contracts that say that the publication owns the rights to this until my words rise above the clouds. It's worked out very well. So
Chip, it makes a lot of sense if you just consider basic legal theory, please.
it's the equivalent of when pigs fly, right? Like,
yeah.
Well, and it really makes me question, do they not consider fog clouds? Because you know, Scotland is fairly overcast and fog rolls in, and one could argue, but obviously they did not. So I wonder if it's a belief system as well.
Maybe the fog only came in during the day.
Gargoyles was an amazing show on the Disney Afternoon that only ran for one episode.
It's really sad when they got turned to the stone at the end, and that was it. So in our present day, the gargoyles are awakened. I do love the design of the castle on the skyscraper, although it makes virtually no sense. It's incredibly distinctive, and it's got a lot of character.
We were trying to figure out where Xanatos's skyscraper fits in the New York skyline.
Oh, yeah, where is
and
it?
And because they do show, they show the Chrysler Building a lot. They showed the Empire State Building, I think, basically once. So my viewing partner's working theory is that it's the MetLife Building, which in the MCU movies is also what they made the Avengers Tower.
So. Prime real estate.
Oh, so he really is jerky Tony Stark.
Yeah,
I approve.
Oh, that's great.
Love it.
I'm here to help.
Oh, it's called the Erie Building. The Erie Building.
Yes,
like
it is called,
Erie Building.
You're right. It is called the Erie. I think they do refer to it that at some point.
That's great. He also, I love the fact, again, 1990s, some strange thing. I mean, not quite accurate. There's like one bored, sleepy security guard guarding the elevator to any place in the building.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, he's very trusting, David Xanatos.
Yeah, that's right. It was the 90s. There's one board security guard and there's four mercenaries with laser guns everywhere you go.
Well, it's just,
it was a great economy. What can we say?
It's good for villains. We do have this interesting, we get a little bit of backstory when the Gargoyles wake up and Xanatos, you know, sort of introduces them, tells them what's going on. We do learn the Magus wrote down the story and that Xanatos has the grimoire. We also get, they actually get asked about the, they ask about the eggs in the rookery, which he says are gone and they're the last gargoyles. Sort of, we'll just like asterisk the heck out of that one. But I love those because they also lie down threats. Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. I love that because they
also
lay down those threats.
He's lying at that
point. That is also true. And then we get this interesting episode where these commandos show up and basically jump in, and appear to run around and steal something from Xanatos and then flee again. And the gargoyles sort of fight them off and Xanatos thanks them. But we get this whole weird, that's the beginning of the first episode where we have this whole firefight and stuff like falling off the building, chunks of stone, etc. And so we have, at least that's what draws our detective Elisa Mazza in, as she comes to investigate what could leave claws in solid stone.
The fight scenes are a little long for my liking, but they have some nice moments in it. I think my favorite one in here is when a evil commando throws like a grenade at and Lexington like catches it and then like tosses it aside because he doesn't know what a grenade is.
Yep.
It's like, I get it. Punch, 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 explosion, explosion, explosion.
I think a little of that was trying to sort of give a money shot to each character.
Yeah.
And, you know, juggling all the different characters. I think that's part of what drove that.
Yeah.
Yeah, even Xanatos gets walk to judo around flip the, a guy.
I'm never going to walk around the Erie Building, though, because, man, there are always, like, bricks and all kinds of stuff falling down. Like, it must be like a death zone.
He paid off a lot of code inspectors, is all I'm saying.
It's a pretty elaborate scam very shaggy scam that Xanatos is running in this story. And I think that towards the end, it's sort of where everything sort of falls apart. But it's kids action adventure TV, and they're still finding their way. And the assault on the castle, the humor bits as the gargoyles are complete fish out of water, you know, it's a lot of fun for me.
Yeah, I'm willing to buy it. I mean, I think it establishes that he's kind of ridiculously Machiavellian, and that probably this, because as we discover later, this whole fight was staged by him. But I'm willing to buy it that it's equal part. He has overly complicated evil plans, and he wants to test out the gargoyles slash his own amusement to be part of the basically the fight, because he wants to shoot a laser gun at some people. So,
yeah, I mean, it fits very well with Xanatos' character.
The liabilities, according to Owen, has informed him that shooting his own employees is safer than shooting strangers. So,
did anybody dig
New York City in the early 90s. So,
yeah. Did anybody dig the giant discs? I really like the giant discs.
They're zip discs.
Or optical discs. I used to use optical discs a few years before that were like, looked like giant floppies. And I think that's what they were trying to depict. I mean, they really weren't trying to depict
them
that,
as hard. I think you'll find that those were actually magic talismans.
Yeah. I love how condescending Xanatos is about that. Like, he thinks he's being really like helpful.
Well, there is the briefing where he's like, I need you guys to go on my commando raids. And they're like, whoa, you have a screen that shows pictures. Yeah. And it's like, oh, yeah. Dude, maybe these are not the guys you need to like go into a laboratory. How are they going to find a disc?
I do love Jonathan Frakes' delivery on your naivete is refreshing.
Yeah.
Yes. So slimy and good. Like, it's the worst parts of Riker, right? Like, it's the worst, like, sleazy parts of Will Riker crossed with Tony Stark.
It is true. When you have magic, though, and you can, you know, and you're in a world of magic, it's like all the machinations of things or machines and screens are not quite as amazing to you. You know, you probably have seen things in mirrors and scrying ponds and things already.
It's a moving tapestry. So we have Elisa investigates this whole bizarre firefight, and Owen, who is Xanatos' assistant, tries to get rid of her, but she's still snooping around. Yeah, Owen is a person who is not given a lot of screen time in this episode, but is certainly one of my favorite characters for reasons that become apparent yes. less later on.
He's yes. delightful.
And he's also just, yes, the delivery and his persona is fantastic.
Yeah, the youngest, snarkiest Alfred you could ever imagine.
Yes.
such a straight man. Such a straight
and
man.
Very, very good.
Future revelations just hilarious.
So we have our first encounter between Elisa and Goliath, where Goliath, as Tony mentioned, crushes Elisa's gun. She stumbles off the building and he saves her. And then they climb back up and they seem to start to establish a rapport. She explains she's a detective. And there's, you know, basically things that she's investigating. She investigates when things don't fit together. And we get a nice line about her saying a good detective trusts no one. And Goliath said that's one thing we have in common. Goliath's fear of being betrayed again runs very strongly through this entire episode, and that is again a nice note of complexity I think for these characters, that even though we have Xanatos, he doesn't entirely trust Xanatos, he doesn't entirely trust Elisa at the beginning either, and we see just how badly he was affected by the events of the of Scotland.
So yeah, which in his timeline was basically yesterday,
right?
So
right.
And yet he throws that questioning completely away when Damona comes back into his life, like,
yep.
which almost makes that betrayal and that interaction even more intense, because you've seen him. Okay, yeah, he's got his other buddy gargoyles, and here's someone that saved his life and yada yada, but still questioning. And then, oh, his angel of the night comes back and all is forgiven, and then just stab in the heart, and oh, it's so painful.
the pathos.
Yes.
Pathos.
Yeah, speaking of pathos, this run of shows has some great subtle dialogue here and there, like when Elisa asks Goliath, there's more than one of you, and he says barely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that nice growl too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we have Xanatos giving the briefing about these stolen discs by cyberbiotics and how he's going to send them out to recover them. We also get the idea now that something else is going on, where he tells the shadowy figure that everything is going according to plan. Subtle animation is hard to do, because you have that moment of, like, especially when you're watching this back to back, you're like, well, it's clearly Damona, right? Like, it's the shape of her and everything and the shadows. But yeah, not so much with that. We get the discussion.
I gotta say, airships, you know, giant skyships, you know, you'd think after, what, the Avengers, the Doctor Who, End of Time, or not End of Time, the Sound of Drums, what's the other, Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow, you know, these giant airships, these giant propeller-powered airships, they always go down. They always crash. Well, why? I mean, it's
Chekhov's airship.
Chekhov's. Thank you. You're right. That's very good.
We get a discussion with Goliath and Elisa about names. And this is where Hudson gets his name. And Elisa and Goliath go sightseeing throughout the city while Hudson discovers television. We get our aforementioned mugging scene with the yuppies, who I believe show up in the background in a few more episodes as well, as I recall. One of them.
Yeah, that was something else that they tended to bring these like minor characters yes. back.
Yeah, so we got.
There's only like seven people in New York City, is my understanding.
Yeah. Also, Margot, who is clearly also voiced by Marina Sirtis as well, which I enjoy. Goliath beats up the thugs, and Elisa's very happy and like, oh, you're the best thing that could happen to the city. That's right, because the city cannot be policed by police officers. It can only be policed by mystical guardrails.
Dan, the answer to everything is vigilante justice. I don't think you understand. Be they turtles or Batman, this is what the city needs.
And then,
look, it was rough in the 1990s, man.
And then our thugs show up, our commandos show up, and shoot Goliath full of some sort of sedative or something. The Goliath and Elisa flee. The boys who are out trying to sightsee and have found a motorcycle, among other things, and then blown it up. Lots of stuff also blows up in these episodes.
Surely that character will never return.
Yeah. this universe has a lot of extra oxygen in the air, I think, based on...
Well, you know, I mean, flammable.
Central Park blow up, that thing blowing up, stuff blowing up in the tower.
There were just... We just kept gas cans everywhere in the 90s, so...
and along the way, we get the very distinct personalities for the boys. We find out pretty clearly that Lexington is going to become Donatello. He's going to become the tech person. Broadway is at least on the surface the jolly hedonistic eating stuff type, and Brooklyn is
Raphael.
Brooklyn, we figure out a little later on that he's kind of Goliath in training, but he's not there yet.
Yeah,
he's a little bit more goth than Goliath.
That's he's a little emo.
He's cool but crude.
Yes. Reference acknowledged.
We do get a funny scene where they try to, when they realize they can't get back to the tower easily, try to hail a cab, which I enjoy.
Oh man.
And as Elisa and Goliath are fleeing, they discover that Goliath has a radio tracker on him with a logo on it. Elisa puts it on a dog.
The logo.
I love the logo.
What happened to that dog? We never see that dog again.
You don't want to know what happened to the dog.
They're still following. We have a fun... So as we mentioned up top, Elisa discovers that they, like, despite the fact that Goliath has tried to hide this whole stone sleep thing from him, that like she discovers it when they can't make it back before dawn. And he, you know, explains briefly before he turns stone that he's totally vulnerable during day. So she tries to lead the commandos away, and we get a really great action sequence as she takes them out. She goes through the boathouse. The boathouse blows up. She lures a guy in with a jacket. Like,
notice those were all rowboats also, by the way, but hey, that's okay. You need the gasoline for the rowboats. I don't remember the waterfall and the sheer cliff in Central Park, but I must exist. I'm going to leave
it to canon. It does not exist.
It's a big park. I'm sure there's somewhere.
Yeah, it is also a big park that is, because it's 1994, empty at broad daylight as four men with mercenaries.
It was so dangerous. No one dared be in that park.
I wondered about that in the scene where she runs through the cafe, but it's also dawn because he's just turned to stone. Yeah. So it's probably a little early.
It's more like Morningside Park.
I mean, they call that the mercenary hour, Dan.
Anyone runs into the first jogger when she finally circles back to Goliath.
Oh, that's true.
Right.
Anyone who lived in New York City in the late 1980s, if I say it's more like Morningside Park, is laughing at home now. Or in their car.
We do get the nice bit with the jogger who's like, man, I've run through this park for 5 years. I've never seen that statue before, which is a funny bit.
And then he just keeps going, though, because it's very New York. New Yorker, you know? Oh, okay. I just missed it. It's cool.
Elisa stays with Goliath all day, which finally basically earns her some trust, right? Because she's protected him. And that is a bond, right? That sort of establishes a bond that we don't have with Xanatos, even though Xanatos is the one who has brought them all back. Upon returning, we get the clan gets all of their names. My notes here says, like, well, we know they can't read, so I guess they're just all things they overheard. And clearly they overheard a lot of things.
Right. Yeah. They've had a very busy day.
Right. So we've got Lexington, Broadway, Brooklyn, and Bronx.
I mean, look, they're speaking modern English, so we have some accommodation to make.
Anyway. It's fair.
True.
Magic.
Gargoyles magic. Have very flexible brains, as brought about because of their origins that are magic.
They're a universal translator magic. Built in.
Xanatos wants to see Goliath, and we get the reveal of Demona, and we get a reunion between the two lovebirds. Demona tells a story about basically going after Goliath and then having, when she realized they've turned to stone, having the Magus cast the spell again. And Xanatos says that he acquired her first. This is also somewhat questionable, but interesting. Like, this is another thing I like about this show is layered narratives, right? Like, we're already suspicious because of the way this is presented. We're suspicious of these characters. And a lot of this stuff will end up being things that turn out to be inaccurate, not inaccurate, but like they're dissembling, right? Which is another fascinating thing that we don't get a lot, I feel like, in shows of this era.
Well, in my memory, I always knew that Xanatos was the bad guy. Like,
yeah, you know, I mean, he's got a ponytail, he's got a goatee, he wears a black right? trench coat. I mean, do you need to see his tax returns to know he's evil? So.
And so in the first episodes when he's, you know, nice and he saved them and all of this stuff, I was just like, did I completely forget the entire
you really misread
purpose
this character.
Of the I was very, very confused. And so when it all turns out, I'm like, okay, my memory isn't that bad.
We get them all sent on their missions to all these various sites, which include some fun confrontations. We get some character development moments as we realize that Demona is pretty callous about human lives. and Goliath is still not quite ready, despite having been betrayed by humans, to sort of categorically dismiss all humans.
I do like that every guard in every facility is incapable of shooting anybody, though no one ever gets hit, right? And any of the... someone actually get a bullet in them or whatever?
No, I don't think so.
At any point?
I don't think so.
Nope. Stormtroopers.
I mean, I know it's a cartoon, but it's still like, that's a lot of shooting.
Yeah, there are a lot of guns in these sequences, but yeah, not a lot of people actually getting violently hurt.
Yes.
We get the kids go to this tower and get, you know, essentially ambushed by a bunch of guards, but they manage to get their way out. We get Hudson, who is the savvy old timer. He tricks his way in by essentially, yes, like, you know, giving himself up and then having Bronx come in and save him. Demona destroys the airship despite Goliath wanting to save people. She sort of drags him out. And Elisa sees Goliath and Demona leaving the crashed airship, and she's sort of, her suspicions are raised. Demona tries to convince Goliath that humanity is basically their enemy and that Xanatos is the only one they can trust. He is not quite buying it, and this is when the cracks in this relationship start to show. Goliath goes to see Elisa, who reveals that the logo that we saw on the radio tracker is a company that belongs to Xanatos. Maybe just don't make your logo so prominent. I don't know. Whatever.
Dan, branding matters. So. Dan, why won't you engage with brands on trackers?
I'm really trying hard not to. This tracker was not GDPR compliant. So we also get the revelation, of course, that Xanatos has tricked them into stealing all these discs from Cyberbiotics, and that he staged the quote-unquote theft in the first place. Xanatos, realizing the gargoyles can no longer be relied upon, decides he's going to trust his replacements that he has now enabled with this technology he has stolen. And we have the introduction of the Steel Clan, which are all gargoyle robots designed to look like Goliath for some reason. I guess because he's the coolest looking one.
Very
Tony Stark, having all our robots fly around with laser cannons and shoot at all the gargoyles. But the gargoyles manage to fight them off. And then Demona sort of turns on them. She's got a rocket launcher, decides to use that. And we get the revelation that she worked with the captain, basically, to try and betray all the humans in the castle. And she reveals that she has a name that the humans gave her long ago, and it's Demona. Elisa tackles her. The tower comes down. Xanatos is knocked out. Goliath saves Elisa, but lets Demona fall. And there's an echo shot of the same reaction he has when he first thought she was dead way back in Scotland, which is kind of a nice callback.
I do like, someone mentioned earlier, though, the fact that he just, it was Chip's opening line, the fact that he just boldly says, like, it's really, you're the one who's responsible for all this. You made it all happen. So, you know, if you're mad at any, I mean, he doesn't say this in that detail, but it was a really great thing to have somebody in a show like this to say, this is all your fault. And it really is. Totally. Yeah.
And she will have none of it. You know, she's not going to accept it. Everybody else has got to pay.
Yep. And then we have a scene where Goliath hangs Xanatos over the edge and he's going to drop him. And of course we have our, our classic, but if you do, you'll be the same as Demona. Right. And so Goliath, you know, showing his heroism, allows Xanatos to instead be arrested on theft, I guess. I don't know. The charges are questionable.
that nice Mr. Xanatos, I will double sew his shirt lining, I guess, so it doesn't tear.
And we have the gargoyles sort of staying in the castle. We've established Elisa is gonna watch out for them, and maybe she'll take them to a football game, apparently.
And that is where we end our introductory arc, setting up a lot of these pieces. And it could have very easily gone from this to becoming a show that was just like a very episodic bad guy of the week. With all the, I mean, these ingredients, right? Like, there's a lot of shows I feel like once you've done the pilot episode, everything else is kind of interchangeable. And I think that's again, the part of this show that I responded to so much was we jump off from this into a very complex exploration of all of mm-hmm. these characters and plots.
They do a lot of world building in this show compared to, other stuff at the time, right? It almost felt like it mm-hmm. was, you know, are we building a TV show or like could this have been like an RPG campaign or something, yeah, sure, right? Sure. There's going to be all these overlapping factions and people with complicated intersecting backstories and people who have been married and who have parents who are, you know, at war with other people. And it's, yeah, you know, for kids.
Yeah. I don't remember how it got scheduled, but there were only 13 episodes in the first season, and I'm pretty sure that it ran at Awakenings ran as a daily 5-day strip.
In yeah, the there is a afternoon. Movie edit of it, but it removes mm-hmm. some things and rearranges some stuff. So yeah, it's not quite as complete.
So, but I think that first season was, aside from running for a week, I think it was weekly. I think it was syndicated weekly or something like that. But so just 13 episodes to, and it's a reasonably complete story there, but they still set up the seeds for if they got renewed. And so the second season brings it to a total of like 65 episodes. So you've got your full on Disney rotation thing going, and there is just so much. Not only is there the serial plot going on throughout, but they take all of these amazing side trips to cover just about every possible human mythology you can possibly get in this series, from various from various ghost and goblin types of things to the Illuminati of all things to my personal vote for the worst gargoyle story, the one about the Easter Island aliens.
I don't remember that
one. Yeah, that's not a great one.
I'm not voting on that one for the rest of this rundown.
We're leaving aside
all of season three.
Season three doesn't exist.
Fans consider non-canonical. Never basically, I think, at this point.
There was a third season that aired during Saturday mornings.
On a different network. It was called
The Goliath Chronicles. It's pretty bad.
Oh, that's right.
It's not good. I don't recommend it.
Hey, folks, Easter Island is not season three, though. I'm sorry to tell you.
No, I think it's season two.
No, it's season two. It's part of the journey.
So, I'm glad that we got a chance to talk about these first five episodes. Does anybody else want to interject with anything before we go our ways?
It's almost sunrise.
How well that they sort of like thought things through, you know, that as Glenn already talked about the gliding thing. Mm. You know, Chip and I noticed this time around, while they're in Scotland and there's lots of room to move, a lot of them are running on all fours, like their physiology is, you know, is they're leaping along like wolves or lions. And then once they're in New York, you almost never see that again because, well, there's no room to run.
Yeah.
So they're walking on feet, 2 feet instead. But they're very consistent with their movements and what's possible and what isn't possible with them. And it's just a lot of thought and care went into the world building, I think, and I think it shows.
Yeah, the design, too. The thing that I remarked upon when looking at the first episode, and it's even shown there, is the use of the wings as cloaks is, I think, one of the best, such a great design move because it... Not only is it elegant in terms of its usage and everything, but it makes the character somewhat more relatable because it makes their silhouettes more human. And so I think that's a really fascinating choice of design, and it's just a really nice little detail.
Oh, I noticed in watching it this time that Damona has like little hand clawy things that she uses, and some of the others. Goliath has kind of more of like a talon sort of thing, but it's even down to that level of design. They are all, everyone is their own custom kind of way of bringing their wings around themselves.
They're individuals. They have types, but they're individuals.
And some of it is, I had forgotten kind of how toyetic some of the design is, where it's like, we need to be able to sell six different action figures. But it also means like they're all very, and they each has a different color scheme and a very different shape, right? So they're very distinctive in a complicated scene with fighting or people in silhouette and whatnot.
Yes, remember how low resolution TV was then? It was very hard to tell things apart.
Yeah, the show has not been remastered for high definition. That is clear.
I still want to get into whether they're oviparous or not, because I'm very confused about the
name. All right. So, Glenn, I feel like that's my cue to wrap this up.
Yes, please.
Well, all right. We have covered the first five episodes. I think we're actually going to try in future episodes to cover the rest of season one, at least, because it's fairly short. Whether we do one or two episodes at a time, I haven't quite figured out yet, but I'm looking forward to getting some more panel in and maybe some other contributors as well to talk about the rest of season one, and we'll see how that goes, and maybe we'll move on to season two after that. But until then, I would like to thank my panel from today. Kathy Campbell, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Dan, for letting me experience my childhood again.
You're quite welcome. Glenn Fleischman, pleasure having you on.
It was great, and I'm glad to revisit a show I really loved and did not have a motivation to rewatch until talking about it, so thank you.
You're welcome. Shannon Sutter, thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure to talk about stuff I love.
Yes, isn't it? Chip Sutter, thank you so much.
Offer me a podcast about gargoyles, and I'll follow you into hell.
Well, good news.
Wow.
Tony Sindelar, thanks for joining us on this amazing adventure.
Goodbye, nerds.
And thank you all out there for listening. We will be back next time on Gargoyle Library.